been working together on the production of the Violence Free Bonds, which we'll be launching today. For those of you who haven't come across our organisations before, Maternity Action is a small national charity working to challenge inequality and promote the health and well-being of pregnant women, new mothers and their families. We focus on legal rights, we work on women's rights at work in the benefit system, and we also have a program of work specifically targeting vulnerable migrant women. Obviously, today's theme is very much part of that. We've got a very busy advice line providing advice on all the issues that come on our website, and we have about 30 information sheets on our website covering pretty much all the legal rights of pregnant women that we can think of. I'm hoping that many of you might have attended our training on improving care for refugee and asylum seeking women, which we delivered a few years back. And you may also be aware of our research, where maternity doesn't matter, on the impact of dispersal policies on asylum seeking women, which covers about the room for women. With us today is the Asylum Support Appeals Project. ASAP is a national charity based in East London, which has the aim of protecting asylum seekers' legal rights to food and shelter. They offer advice and training to advisors and free legal advice and representation to asylum seekers who appear their case. Refusals of asylum support at the tribunal in East London. Their website has a lot of very useful information, which I encourage you to have a look at. And they also deliver a second tier advice line. Today we're launching Guidance for Midwives to help obtain housing and financial support for pregnant women whose asylum claim has been refused. The asylum seeking and refugee women have some of the worst maternal health outcomes of women living in the UK. There is an urgent need to focus on what can be done to improve the health of these mothers and new babies. It is an appalling situation that so many of these women are left without accommodation or basic financial support during their pregnancies. For most women, home office support only kicks in 6 weeks before the baby is due. This is an inhumane way to treat women who live in the UK, but it's also an important factor in the very poor maternal health outcomes for these women. So Maternity Action and the Asylum Support Appeals Project have been working for several years to find ways to use the law to gain support for refused asylum seeking women earlier in pregnancy. And that's the guidance that we're releasing today. We have some very good speakers here this afternoon, some great speakers here. First of all, we have Hazel Williams, Director of the Asylum Support Appeals Project. She'll be speaking on the legal aspects of Section 4 support for refused asylum seekers. Then Damien McGuffin, Consultant Obstetrician at Barnes and St Thomas's and elected member of the Royal College of Obstetrician and Gynaecologists. She's worked very closely with Maternity Action and ASAP on development of the guidance. After that, we'll hear from Sabia Sarej, founder of EVA Organisation for Women, who'll be speaking about her experience of giving birth as an asylum seeker. Followed by Cathy Warwick, Chief Executive of the Royal College of Midwives, well known to all of you, I'm sure. And Monica Polifari, who's a midwife with experience of working with refugee and asylum seeking women, currently working at Leicester University Hospital Trust. So I'd now like to introduce Hazel Williams, Director of the Asylum Support Appeals Project.
So welcome everyone, it's so great to see so many people here. We didn't quite anticipate such a good turnout, it's excellent. So today we're going to talk a little bit about what accommodation and support pregnant women who are homeless, they have their asylum claim refused, that what they might be entitled to. So importantly, just to separate, I'll not be talking about EU migrants, I'll be talking purely about women who've come to the UK in search of safety, they've applied to the Home Office for refugee protection, unfortunately they have been refused that, so it's quite a specific group of women. I'll also be talking importantly about what you as midwives can do to help those women access support. So it's quite information heavy and I've tried to not make it too legal, which is probably quite confusing. So do bear with me and there'll be plenty of time for Q&A as well. So just to give you some context about the whole kind of what's going on in asylum, obviously you'll have seen the news and the refugee crisis happening that's going on at the moment. In terms of how many people claim asylum in the UK, last year it was 25,000 people, so it's quite low if you think about our overall population. And roughly about 40% of those people will be granted some form of protection to stay in the UK permanently. Interestingly though, women have a bit of a raw deal, they've got a higher chance of being refused asylum first time. And the good news is there's a very high rate of overturns on appeal, so that means people are accessing refugee protection eventually. So when a person claims asylum, asylum, as you hopefully you're aware, they're not entitled to work. In contrary to, you know, some of the popular press might say, they're not entitled to claim mainstream benefits. So the type of support that I'll talk about today comes from the Home Office, and it's quite limited support. People also, they may arrive in London, but then they're dispersed all around the UK, and they normally have no choice about where they're sent to live. Interesting, for example, the North West houses the most asylum seekers in the UK today. So the type of support they receive, if they've been refused asylum, there might be the option that they can apply for what we call Section 4, which is just the section in the Act. So in the briefing it talks a little bit about that. Practical tips, that's accommodation. Often shared accommodation and not particularly nice, pleasant accommodation, as you can imagine. And it's just £5 vouchers a day that they receive, and that's for essential living needs. It's not so much. So, how might they be eligible? We'll talk a little bit about that. First of all, they have to be destitute. That's the most important thing. So, it means they have to have no access to accommodation or no way of meeting their essential living needs. And that could be on that day, so they could be street homeless on that day, or it might mean within the next 2 weeks of the street homeless. So, first of all, they're destitute. For a woman who's pregnant and she finds herself destitute and she's had a refugee protection claim refused, then she has to prove that she's unable to travel. So that's the kind of important thing. It means she can't actually physically get on a plane to travel. And it's important to remember that the Home Office, they're not really concerned with the fact that this person might be homeless and in a very terrible situation. It's clear that she has to prove that she can't travel. Also, they talk a lot about whether it's fit to fly, which I'll talk a little bit more about. And in the application for support, it's quite important, is where we come in a lot, is that they're often refused support applications from the Home Office, so, and they can appeal that. And that's kind of where you come in a lot of the time, so quite frequently refuse asylum support, but very, very high success on appeal. It's over 65% of people who refuse that support when they have the tribunal. So, what's defined as not fit to fly? So if you're 34 weeks pregnant, then they say that's fine, except that you can't get on a plane. All we need from you guys is the MAP B1, prove the destitute, and they can access the asylum support. What's more tricky is they say that if there's complications with the pregnancy, and there's medical evidence proving that, they say there'll be a risk to the unborn child or to the woman themselves, that would say that there's a risk of travelling, then they might be entitled to support. So what's really important is that medical evidence. You can't get anyone support without that medical evidence that talks about how there's a risk for them travelling. So rather than talk through the law, I'm going to give you some examples about how we've been able to get people into this support before the 34 weeks. So 34 weeks is fine, so we're trying to get people access to support before that. So the cases that I'm talking about were all refused asylum support initially, and then they appealed that at the tribunal, which is where we represented them. They were all destitute, that was not disputed, so they were either street homeless or didn't have adequate accommodation for the next 2 weeks. And they were all obviously pregnant. So the first was an Iranian lady who's with her husband. She was suffering quite poor mental health problems. She was hearing voices, she was having hallucinations. And when she came before the judge, she was 28 weeks pregnant, so 6 weeks before the usual limit when we get support. The primary concerns were around her mental health as opposed to the kind of physical health problems. And before the judge, she had some excellent evidence. She had a letter from a midwife, and the letter specifically classified her pregnancy as high risk. So this is kind of exactly what we want evidence-wise. And it actually said that she shouldn't advise against her flying. That was perfect. The judge basically looked at the evidence along with some referrals for a site assessment and said that woman's entitled to support. So it should hopefully always be as simple as that, but it's not. The second example was around more about social risk factors. So that's what Doug will talk a little bit more about, how they can come into play and how they can affect whether someone's able to fly or not. So this was a Tanzanian woman. She was 32 weeks pregnant, so a little bit late into her pregnancy. She had a combination of quite minor medical complications. So she had fibroids and anemia, but she had a significant social risk factor. So she was a victim of domestic violence, which had actually worsened during the pregnancy, and she was also street homeless. So the judge considered all this and also looked at the evidence from Bagby's report and said, well, actually in this case, it's not recommended that she could fly because of these additional risk factors, so they granted her support. That's a good example of where it's not just someone's physical health, it can be the situation of the woman that impacts on her ability or whether it's safe for her to fall. So the last example I give you is a Chinese lady. She was 27 weeks pregnant when she came before the judge. She had medical notes with her, but no specific evidence from a health professional. But the medical notes showed that she had hepatitis B and history of miscarriage. So even though there was no specific evidence, the AFAP representative who helped this lady was able to pull off the internet some kind of research and a fact sheet that said she had B showed that the woman with this condition had a higher risk of premature birth and heavy bleeding in late pregnancy. And for the judge in that case, that was enough to say that it wasn't recommended she should travel. However, if we hadn't been there and that lady had gone before the judge on her own, that evidence, because there was no evidence from a midwife or a health professional making that link, she probably would have been refused to find support and carried on being homeless. So I'll finish there, and I just want to emphasise again the important role that you as midwives can play and how vital this evidence is, because we without it are not able to get people into support. Also, I mean, some of the cases are only, 32 weeks pregnant, so she would have got support 2 weeks later, but those 2 weeks can be absolutely crucial in these women's lives, and we all know a lot can happen in those 2 weeks. So thanks for listening, and I hope that what we're hoping for today is that more women can access support in their pregnancy. Thank you. I was just looking around the room and I thought, isn't it interesting there aren't any men here? And two, it's interesting that the people who've shown interest in this are mainly midwives and one obstetrician, and that probably is a sad indictment on us as healthcare professionals providing care for vulnerable women. And I know we're here to speak about one particular small group of vulnerable women, but actually if we get care right for them, and if we provide care, we talk about compassionate care in the NHS the whole time. Well, this is demonstrable compassionate care, which relates to care that we provide to all our other women. So it's slightly disappointing, but those of you that are here can do your little bit to help that. But I was very privileged to be asked to help write this report, which essentially is really for legal advice. The basics of it, in that I think most of you as midwives are very well aware of certain medical complications in pregnancy, poor pregnancy outcomes, both for the mother and baby. And when I talk about medical complications, I'm not just talking about the physicality of it, it's mental health as well, and mental well-being of this woman who is giving birth and then going to be part of a family. So there are wider implications to this. The social complexity is something that many of you will be aware of, but actually the wider public audience don't always understand what social complexity is when we talk about it in medicine. And they see medical conditions and then they see some social issues and they don't understand the impact. Just to demonstrate that, and this is data you'll know because it's from the Embrace report, I just wanted to reiterate two statistical facts, which most of you will know. So in the, and this is the Embrace UK report on maternal deaths was women who died. So a very small cohort of the women that you and I look after across the UK. And the sociodemographic details of those around ethnicity. So the group that we're talking, asylum seekers, and those who've been refused asylum status, tend to be for have a very high representation of ethnic minority groups. And when you look at women who die in pregnancy and labour, despite the fact that we are an advanced country offering, we say, comprehensive health care, if you are a black African woman, your chances of dying are significantly higher, up to almost 3 times. If you are a black Caribbean woman, again, they are up to 3 times, nearly 3 times the risk ratio, odds ratio of dying. That's really high. If you are in the fourth and fifth quintile of deprivation, almost a quarter to a third of the women who died in the last triennium, so the 3 years of that report, were from those groups. This isn't new data, this isn't something new, this is a phenomenon that's been happening for the last few decades. And up until relatively recently, for some of us, it was data we didn't talk about because it wasn't politically correct to talk about it. Now we do talk about it, and sadly the data hasn't improved for this group of women. So that's just to put it into context of women where things go really badly wrong and they die. What is equally appalling is what we allow to happen to some of their babies. So if you look at the Embrace UK report looking at perinatal morbidity and mortality, I will just read you the 3 lines from this report, which I think are very pertinent for the group of women that we're talking about. First, mothers living in the most deprived areas, and a lot of our women are either relocated or identified to maternity services in very deprived areas, are between 46% and 63% higher risk of poor outcome compared to mothers in the least deprived areas. And some of these least deprived and most deprived areas are right next to each other. Okay, so if you take Richmond and Kingston and you just go a little bit southeast to my patch where I work, that's not that far geographically, and the outcomes of these women are appalling. The stillbirth rate is 1.63. Neonatal mortality rate is 1.46, so 46% more likely for them to have babies that die. Stillbirth rate 63% more likely. And the extended perinatal mortality rate is slightly more sensitive, it's 1.57, so 50% more likely. And with this background, we have refused to accept the risk that this particular group of vulnerable women that we're talking about, asylum seekers, are exposed to. 3 years ago, NICE issued guidance on socially complex pregnancies, and I was on the guideline development group. What was phenomenally difficult is the lack of evidence. And the evidence isn't there because we, as healthcare professionals, academics, society, don't think that evidence is important enough to collect and to publish. And writing this report was particularly difficult because as a clinician and talking to other clinicians who are as involved with vulnerable women, we know the risk factors, but trying to find the evidence which you can then put in front of people to say either we should be providing this service in terms of finance or we should be providing the service in terms of quality, or even more importantly, we should be providing this service because if we want to say that we are a civilized society and we are humane, we should be looking after this very, very small group of women who are not just vulnerable, but they're also pregnant and vulnerable. And they have a huge amount of discrimination. Hazel's just talked about their rates of having their asylum request turned down. It is higher. So my plea is for you to, if you haven't already, cast an eye on the report. Be aware of it. Please let your colleagues know, both your obstetric colleagues and your midwifery colleagues and any other healthcare professionals who might be involved with them. ASAP and Maternity Action have done a lot to try and raise awareness with government, but really this, I think that the major moves are going to come from us as healthcare professionals, increasing public awareness, saying actually this isn't good enough, and it isn't good enough because it doesn't reflect well on us, not just as the NHS, but it doesn't reflect well on us as a society. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.
Although I have
two of my children there. I came to Leicester in 2004, and in 2009 I had my fourth child, which was a boy, and then in 2010 I had my daughter, who's the youngest. So I'm a mom with five children. Fast forward, today I was having my daughter. I arrived just home in January. We have Monica here, who's experienced midwife, community midwife, as well as she at the hospitals there. And to my surprise, though my first time giving birth, I was home in January, everything went quite well to the expectation I had, because I had no experience, though I was actually a nurse and a midwife assistant back in Somalia as well, worked in Denmark. And here I was, after I actually, the midwife had another student who actually delivered my baby. And during the labor, accidentally, the student actually dropped a little bit about my baby. But yet again, it wasn't severe. So my child came up to me, and I was breastfeeding. Because of my condition, somehow I had tip, it took them about 2 to 3 hours to get the doctor to see me. And as soon as he came, she just asked me which number it is, and I said, "Oh, it's number 5." And she said, "Oh, you are a FGM victim." And my answer was yes. She said, she looked briefly. She never took the time that she should to look at me and then make the decision that I was fine. I don't need any stitches. So she left, and I was heavily bleeding. About 5 to 6 hours later, well, my husband left, and I was still in the bed, naked, obviously, but I had some sheets over myself with the baby. And I was actually shaking. The buzzer was very far away from me. The bed I was sleeping, I don't know, but in my recollection, normally when you give birth, you are not in a, sometimes you are in a situation where you don't feel like you are in yourself. So you kind of hope that the side support of the bed will be pulled up, because I was constantly afraid that I'm going to lose the baby. Because I actually haven't slept about a day and a half, and I was still bleeding. So what happened was, after about 5 hours after the doctor arrived and nobody actually came to check on me, I had to either, after like a few minutes, I fell asleep, and then I have to wake myself up, because I still hold my baby and there is no side support around me. So I'm just laying in the bed, the same bed that I gave birth. So I had to actually pull myself up, find the strength. So I knew either I have to lay myself here down and lose somehow my baby, and she will probably be dead. Or I am actually going to die of bleeding. So for the grace of God, I actually found the strength, put my baby aside, and then slowly placed the bus up, which was actually very far away from me. The midwife came, she apologized, and then she saw that I was bleeding. Anyway, they actually take me to the labor, Labour, no, maternity award, because that's where I was the delivery this week. After I actually had some washing and went down. To my surprise, Annette, the next, well, it was late at night, so in the morning Annette came, and I believe it was Annette, and she said, "Oh, what is he doing?" And I said, "It is not he, it is a she." And she looked at her bottom and she said, "Well, it says it is a boy." And I said, "No, it's not a boy, it is a girl." And so she went. A while later, my husband came, another nurse came, I believe it was a nurse, because I cannot remember whether it was a nurse or a midwife, but I assume it was a nurse. And then said, "Oh, is it a boy or girl?" And I said it a second time, "It is a girl." And by the way, I already have 4 boys, so I hope not. And yeah, so basically she said, "Do you mind if I check?" I said, "Yeah, that's fine." And she looked at it. And what actually, it was devastating knowing actually the service that's supposed to be available to every and single of us. But yet again, I couldn't actually I couldn't just process what had happened. And then a few months later, about 8 months later, somebody from the Melbourne University contacted me to do a research. And when I told the story, she said, "Oh, why didn't you actually complain or do something?" And I said, "Complaining would not actually do a big thing, basically, but telling my story will definitely help other midwives to actually pay their attention to their patient. I know there are a lot of cuts, and the health professionals are in a position where they actually are full stress, and I don't understand that. And I actually do not want to cause anybody, you know, or embarrass or like, you know, bad mouth. But what I'm hoping is that my story, somebody actually who might actually lose their baby, you know, by probably accidentally, or actually dying of, you know, hammering, you know, anything could have helped. So my take-home message is that, listen, please, it does not matter. It doesn't matter how many children the baby had. What matters is that she is your patient and she is under your control. I know the midwife and the student, they had to stay over their shift because the girl, the midwife student fell her sons, fell test actually, practical, I can't remember. So that was her last chance and I felt for her. So, you know, dropping my baby, it was harsh, but thank God nothing had happened, so I couldn't actually say anything. And the midwife shared, "Oh, you dropped the baby. You shouldn't do that." And I felt bad in a way because of it's my own baby, but bad for the student as well because that was her last chance as well. So we were talking while I was in the labor, so I knew her situation. So basically my take-home message to you is that when you take over a shift from somebody, please pay attention. I know you have other patients to look after, and I know that you say, "Oh yeah, that lady had her baby, that's fine." Her family member might not actually around, and that's what happened. Unfortunately, my ex-husband, because I was going through a divorce, so we were not actually, so to speak, together per se. But he was there when I was giving birth. And so he left as soon as I had my baby. So please bear that in mind. If I have more time, then I can stop to comment. Okay? Because of the majority, I actually exposed to work with a lot of women. who were asylum seekers, but luckily get their status to actually stay and remain in Britain. And one of the clients that I will talk about, she came as a young girl in Britain, and unfortunately, the midwife assumed, because the girl came as a young age and couldn't speak the language very well, so she never been exposed to FGM. Nobody actually asked her, nobody explained to her. She could remember what happened to her, but she couldn't, she doesn't even know what FGM is. So when she was giving birth, she experienced lack of support, lack of help. And it's not because she couldn't speak the language, but during the labor, nobody actually understood her situation, and nothing was on her report. So obviously, she had to actually herself, and she had to leave FGM. Today, she is suffering a lot of infection, and she cannot hold high urine. So the health visitor has to refer to us to help her, basically. Even the GP is not helping her to actually send her, you know, a referral so that she can have operation or even have, you know, to inject even the antibiotics that the GP described for her wasn't working at all. So for 7 months, she was living in nightmares. So again, it is just paying attention for small details that will make a life changing and might save a lot of people's lives. So thank you for your time. Asylum seekers and I hope we can continue to work together to try and improve things. I mean, I do totally agree with Dagny that if we don't get it right for vulnerable women, who are we going to get it right for? And one of the things I've just been reflecting on as I've been sitting here is that, I mean, I'm part of this NHS England maternity review that's going on at the moment, and I don't think I've heard really vulnerable women talked about yet. And I'm just thinking how awful that is. You know, we're talking about all those wonderful things, personalised care, choice, control, empowerment. I'm not sure it's going to crack it. So I'm now worrying about that, because I think it is right that this group should be our sort of fundamental point of getting it right. So what else did I want to say? I mean, the position is really difficult. And I think one of the things that is difficult in this area is that the prejudice that women in all of these different categories, you know, economic migrants, refused asylum seekers, refugees, the prejudice that these women face is not a prejudice that isn't within the midwifery profession. You know, I actually think some midwives just don't get this in the same way as some of the general public don't get it. So I think we do have a job to do to try and ensure that the whole profession understands, as I think you said, that our code of practice actually requires us to care for everyone without any prejudice. And midwives absolutely cannot be forced into the position of being sort of quasi-immigration officials. It's just not our job. And if that's the job we want to do, we need to kind of get out of this profession, it's my belief. I mean, the NMC code specifically says, and I'll put it to you if I can find it written down here somewhere, because it's not off the top of my head. It actually says that we must not, we must act in partnership with those receiving care, helping them to access relevant health and social care, information and support when they need it. So this is an obligation on all of us. It shouldn't just be those midwives, who I'm sure are the midwives here today, who really want to do this, who are doing it. Other midwives should be helping these women as well. Otherwise, they shouldn't be on the Nursing Midwifery Council register, quite frankly. The NHS Constitution also actually says that we have a duty to each and every individual that we serve, that the NHS serves. It requires the NHS to respect human rights, and at the same time, the NHS has a wider social duty to promote equality through the services it provides, and to pay particular attention to groups or sections of society where improvements in health and life expectancy are not keeping pace with the rest of the population. So I think we must all, in our daily working lives, point out to the people with whom we work that, again, this is our obligation to help people, and particularly to help the most vulnerable. And I do think it is interesting how much, there's a lot of incompatibility, I think, in the system at the moment between these very good sort of rhetoric statements and actually what's happening at a local level. And part of the Royal College of Midwives' role is to help you work through those contradictions. So I think midwives must never lose sight of their role, which is to help everybody when they're in need. I do think it's useful to midwives today that once the baby is born, there is more that we can do to help. But I think we need to increasingly raise the point that what goes on in the woman's pregnancy does have an impact on the unborn child. And it's all very well helping a baby once they're born, but we actually do need to help the babies to have the best experience in utero if they're going to maximise their potential once they're born. And that's an argument that we need to carry on making, so that, in the sense what you described, the pregnant woman not being entitled to any help really gets less support, because helping her in pregnancy actually is helping the baby,
So I think that's an argument we have to make much more. But if we move on from the challenges of what midwives are required to do, obviously the other big challenge for midwives in this area is the complexity, is the difficulty of accessing resources. And I think the Royal College of Midwives and other people have a huge obligation to try and make sure that we disseminate more information so that midwives' lack of knowledge, in a way, doesn't be the thing that causes them to run away from the problem. Because sometimes even when we want to care, if we haven't a clue how to give that care, it does make it really difficult. And for many people, the answer is to retreat and just not to give the care. So I do think we need a lot of knowledge and support. And in fact, the RCM is running a webinar tomorrow through our Better Births campaign, which is all about how we better support vulnerable women. And we'll be trying to put on more information like that. But I think the other thing that's a challenge for midwives working in this area, and particularly for midwives like many of you who are here today, who are really focusing on this as a specialism, I think the big challenge is that you need support. You know, it's not easy giving care to the most vulnerable people. It's very, very demanding. You have to cope with all sorts of hurdles. And so I think the other thing that we need is possibly to create more networks of midwives working in this area. This is a critical area. We need to all work together to try and solve this issue. The challenges for midwives in this area are multiple. You need knowledge, you need connections, you need support. And finally, what the RCM will do is we will continue to lobby to try and ensure that whilst you're taking action at a grassroots level, we do try also to change the system. So we'll continue to speak up for the right of any pregnant woman to receive a high standard of maternity care, regardless of her country of origin or her status in the UK. We'll continue to call, as we've been doing for some time, along with maternity action for the end of detention for pregnant women. We'll continue to call for the end of dispersal for pregnant women and the end, particularly, to charging for maternity health care. And we also want to see improved access to GPs. So we will continue to lobby for all of those things. Thank you.
Thank you.
and I do need to get out. It was just one of those things, and it's an impossible situation. But we have to try. Just like the evening of light, he went again to King Herod and said, no. We say no. We're going to do our jobs as well as we can. Think about what this lectern. Leaning on it. But I have come to this world to tell you that I can't say it in this time that I realize I can't. And I know you all probably experience similar things to what I've experienced. But I want to encourage you, because I know you're working hard. I know your managers might not make good comes out. It's like work harder, work harder, work harder, work harder. There's an organisation, I don't really have one in London, where they deal with people who have the effects of rape and war, torture. Because this requires specialist kind of help. This is not your normal mental health services. This is not your normal safeguarding. This is highly specialised. When you've been raped on your journey to here, when you've been raped as a weapon of war, we're dealing with heavy stuff as we write. And it's hard to articulate. It's hard. We come here and we come on this study day. The first study day I've been on, which will help me with my job. I've been trained as a midwife for 30 years. I've never had training on migrant health issues or vulnerable women, to be honest. I don't know about anyone here, but that's today is the day of my life. I've done a few things with Ross and migrant maternity action, and I've learned a lot in the last, say, 7 years. To be honest, this is kind of like the first or second, third maybe study day that I've been on, which touches on the subjects that I deal with on a daily basis. Can I just get you all to stand and applaud with me? All the midwives that you work with, all the managers, the doctors, maternity action, all the people who are bringing it to the forefront, the people who are no longer saying, pretending, it's not happening. We've seen what's happened in Hungary. It's only a matter of time before some of those women come to us. So let's stand and applaud.
Thank you.